Today on Backroom Politics, the National Governors Association's meeting here in D.C., what are the challenges facing the governors of the states here in America, and is the governorship the right pathway to the White House? More on sequestration. We are literally 4 days away from the cliff. This and the Oscars, Hollywood, and Washington. Is D.C. Hollywood for ugly people, and how close is the relationship between Tinseltown and the Capitol? This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics.
Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics with your moderator, Justin Russell. To join the political discussion today, you can call toll-free at 877-662-3713. And now, with the roundtable, your moderator, Justin Russell.
Everybody out there in Radio Land, it's Tuesday. That means it's time for the best political show you've never heard of. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We've got a full house and a full agenda here on Backroom Politics this week, but I will start out as I always do. To my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Hi, Congressman Al.
Hi, how are you?
Doing fine. Yes. Joining us to his left, which he's not usually, he is the former floor chief for then Congressman Gerald Ford, the former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation for Government Affairs. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Justin, and I really do have to get to the right of Al, but it's not easy.
It's not easy to do. Once in a while. Joining us is our old friend and occasional special guest here on Backroom Politics. He is the in-council of Greenberg Traurig for Government Affairs. He is longtime Washington insider, longtime Senate staffer, John Freshman. Hi, John.
Hi. Great to be here. Thanks.
Good to have you back. We need a loud, boisterous Democrat once in a while. Joining us. I said boisterous. I was pleasant about it. To my 1 o'clock, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce, who has worked for at last count 4 presidents, longtime Senate staffer, longtime Washington insider, and a very handsome and distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Justin, gentlemen.
Good to see you. And to my right, he is the former executive director of the Democratic Party of the great state of Maryland. He is longtime Washington insider, Carl Toobin. Hi, Carl.
Good afternoon, Justin. Glad to be here.
And I'm your moderator, Justin Russell, and we've got a full agenda today. First off the bat, we're going to talk about the National Governors Association's meeting here in Washington, D.C. over the past few days. And lots of rhetoric coming out regarding sequestration, budget shortfalls, and the sort. The big question going out there today on the governors is there are several governors that could be in contention for either the Democrat, but more likely the GOP ticket in 2016. The big question coming out now is, and I'll start with you, John Freshman, when you look at the governors as a whole, it seems that the last few 2-term presidents that we've had have been governors. One would say that your more successful presidents have been governors. Is that the pathway to the White House these days? Can a Washington insider truly be in the White House and serve solidly without being in the governor's mansion first?
Well, that's a great question. Of course, we have an incumbent right now who was a senator, but he's the first senator to win the presidency since John F. Kennedy, you might recall. So it's been a long time, and there have been mostly governors in between. I think that with the difficulty of managing a budget and with the difficulty of being an executive, that the governorship is probably a better training ground on everything, but as we've observed many times, foreign affairs, where they often don't have any experience.
Yeah, but Bob Hines, you know, when we talk about foreign affairs, we talk about the governorship. I mean, other than the fact that, you know, there have been a little hiccup, i.e. Sarah Palin, I can see Russia from my house. But mostly we've seen governors come in with not the strongest foreign affairs background on them, but enough political savvy to at least get it, understand it, and rely on people close to that community to bring them in. Is that an accurate oversight on that?
Well, it's absolutely clear that you need it. You need that kind of talent. If you're a governor, you take a look at someone like Ronald Reagan. Well, he was fortunate. He had people like Jim Baker, and he had people like Howard Baker, people who were able to give him advice and counsel, Brent Scowcroft, people like that. Knowledgeable people is what you really need. Any governor is going to be short on foreign policy experience, but if you're smart enough to go to people who are true experts, even if they're not your close buddies and within the party, the fact of the matter is, that's what you have to do to be successful.
Congressman Al Swift.
Absolutely, and I think it's worth remembering that not every person from Congress who runs for president has a background in foreign policy either, including Barack Obama. So you need to get it, but you often have to get it elsewhere. You don't necessarily come with those bona fides.
Alan Moore, you know, we're seeing a lot of jockeying right now, particularly for the GOP ticket. A lot of the names coming out seem to be governors. It could be somebody like a Chris Christie, could be somebody on the dark side of the horse like a Bobby Jindal as a backrunner on this. No,
that's an interesting choice of words.
All right, I will rephrase. There's a dark horse like a Bobby Jindal coming in that could be considered a contender. We saw Mitt Romney as a contender for the GOP. Does it make sense from a political standpoint to bring that state understanding to the White House?
Well, it does sometimes, but being an executive is good practice for being the chief executive. Being knowledgeable about how Washington works is good for being the chief executive. We've had some of each. Let's remind ourselves, we don't have to go all the way back to Kennedy. LBJ, who was put in as vice president and then elected, his experience was in the Congress and the Senate. Nixon, the Senate. And it's a mix. There's no magic anything. I would take issue with your notion that there's all this jockeying going on and this is the focus. This is 4 years off. There's attention, but I think it's more attention paid by a handful of individuals in the press and probably some of these guys, but we're a long way from knowing who the candidate is in either party.
Well, go ahead, John Freshman.
The focus primarily is actually health care, and there's two parts of it, the state-run exchanges and Medicaid, and I, you know, that it's so complicated, and some are opting into one and opting out of the other, opting out. The Republicans are now coming in on the Medicaid thing because they get more money for their states. That's really a lot of the focus of this governor's
health care. Well, let's talk about that for a second, because there's been a lot of flip-flopping on the governor's side, most notably the most outspoken governor against Medicaid exchange has been Governor Rick Scott out of Florida. He, this past week, announced that he was going to enable the Medicaid exchange down in Florida. Governor Chris Christie today announced that he was going to enable the Medicare exchange program in New Jersey. Is that going to be a trend of rhetoric, and then all of a sudden moving towards the center on this? Alan Moore,
yeah. There's two things. Yeah, I'm not sure it's the exchange that those guys have bought into. What they have bought into is the expansion of Medicaid. And there's a huge difference between those two. If you expand Medicaid, the feds will pay the cost of treating a larger population 100% for several years and 90% after that. It should be no surprise that governors who suffer under the challenges of Medicaid, which is the health system for the poor, are looking for ways to find revenue. Well, here's a way you can expand your coverage and you can get it paid for. Whether you have the doctors and the capacity to serve, different, tougher question.
Call to them.
One of the things that happened in Florida is that the hospital association was evidently whispering to the governor that, you know, you want our support, you better do something for us. And this was a way of doing something for the hospitals.
John Freshman.
And the other issue, besides the one that Alan explained, Medicaid, is this state-run exchange for insurance. And some governors are opting in and some governors are opting out. And I can't really see the pattern there. So they're maybe coming in on the exchange and coming out on Medicaid. There's a lot of sorting out that's happening while they're here.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I think what's happened is a lot of the governors were unsure whether this law was going to be overturned in the courts or possibly legislatively, depending upon the outcome of the election. So they didn't get out in front of creating a statewide exchange. They always could fall back on a federally run exchange. And so some of these Republicans who are now moving towards taking advantage of this Medicaid opportunity are going to opt for the federal exchange, the federal marketplace to buy insurance. There's no clear pattern, but it should be no surprise to anybody that governors strapped for funds are suddenly saying, okay, we didn't like this law, but now that it's the law, clearly moving forward, we want the money to cover our population.
Well, Bob Hines, I mean, when we look at having to invoke the expansion of Medicaid in their states, for example, Florida, New Jersey, most notably, we also have to look at the fact that these are, in large parts, you take a look at Michigan, you take a look at Indiana, these are states that are strapped for cash. Illinois is having a hard problem. California teeters on bankruptcy consistently. How is the governor going to be able to balance running a state, providing those services, yet at the same time trying to get their fiscal house in order?
Well, one of the ways they can do it is, just as John and Alan have said, they can in effect go in with both the Medicaid assistance and the exchanges. It's probably, for most of the states, it's probably the only way that they can keep their budget balanced, even close, because the biggest expense right now in almost any governor's pocketbook the state is the medical costs that he's got to deal with under Obamacare, with all those many, many millions of people who have not had care before are now eligible for policies and care.
But Congressman Al, I mean, when you look at the largest nut that these states have to balance fiscally, you are talking about medical insurance that is provided in some instances by the state or medical subsidies by the state. You're looking at retirement systems for your state employees. Is there a way to touch that quote-unquote non-discretionary spending at the state level without it affecting truly what may be coming down from the federal government in support of it?
No, I don't think so. I think that's a dream, and there are a lot of people that are living in a dream world these days.
Alan Moore.
Well, what the states have been doing, because they're suffering in the economic crash of the last 5 years, like everybody else is, and sometimes in a more exaggerated way, they are taking a look at what they're providing, what they can afford, and making changes. Mitch Daniels in Indiana was very aggressive about cutting spending in the state of Indiana, and it turned out that he was able to do that. They create sort of new benefit levels for new employees, this two-tiered system that states and some companies have adapted, which is very controversial, but it's about one of the only ways you can save money in the long term. Get your fiscal house in order as a state, and guess what? Employers will say, that's the kind of place we would like to go to. So success breeds success. But there's mixed experience all over the country on that.
John Freshman?
A fascinating, unbelievable sub-story, which, based on what you were talking about, is the state that is on the way to balancing its budget and has kind of almost gotten there is California, under the second go-round of Jerry Brown, who's back here in town.
Right. Which we never thought we'd see again.
Yeah,
he keeps
true.
Popping up. But we also see a lot of infighting. There's a lot of infighting going on amongst the states for the creation of jobs. You know, we see what happened with Boeing, moving jobs from Washington State, Congressman Al, over to South Carolina. We see huge tax benefits being offered to corporations like Honda, Volkswagen, BMW. Is that going to be a trend we're going to continue to see, the fighting between the states for the best deal to get those jobs in place?
Well, that's always been going on. And I would correct you on one thing. Jobs weren't moved from Seattle to somewhere else. New jobs were created somewhere else rather than in Washington State.
Okay.
So you still build a 747 in Everett. So.
Right. Carl Toobin.
You also have the fact that the governor of Texas advertised in California for corporations to move to Texas and all the advantages to move to Texas, which the governor of California didn't like one bit.
But now when we look at, you've also got public safety issues. I mean, a governor's got a real challenge. How do you maintain a level of public safety without having to cut back on personnel, cut back on the offerings in the benefits package? That's a hard balance to teeter there, John Frank.
Well, that's right. And the minute we get somewhere in terms of stabilizing the crisis in healthcare costs, we're going to stumble right into the next thing, which is the crisis in retirement benefits and underfunded state and local pension plans. I'm not talking about private sector plans, which have problems of their own. I mean, these liabilities, when you're a police officer doing all that great work, but if you're able-bodied, you can retire at age 45 years old with 20-year service, and the local taxpayers are going to pay for your retirement for the rest of your life. I mean, these people are carrying those kind of obligations. It's incredibly difficult.
Well, we've also seen, Bob Hines, we've seen a lot of the governors try and act the right-to-work protocols, making their states right-to-work states without having to worry about union-negotiated benefits. Is that going to be a trend we're going to see out of governors in the coming years?
I'm sure there'll be some states that, you know, that haven't moved that way yet, that if they're red states, they'll probably try to do something like that. But the fact of the matter is, we're probably seeing most of what we're likely to see with respect to governors that haven't yet tried it with have a legislature that'll let them do it. I mean, mind yourself that, the states that do it are almost all right to work states. You know, you're not going to get anything else. I mean, right to work is going about, I think, almost as far as you can find. I don't know any state right now that I would say is a likely state to go to a right to work.
Well, don't forget, we're talking about public employees and private employees, so we're kind of talking about two different things.
Correct. I mean, but when you look at a state like Michigan, where if somebody had told you 4 years ago, John Freshman, that Michigan would go right to work state, that's a shock that nobody saw coming, yet it passed tremendously through the state legislature there. That's got to be a trend that other governors, Republican in particular, are seeing, that is it worth the dice roll to make it and push it through their state or Congressman Al.
But part of that goes back, I think, to what John just said, and that is, of all the workers in the country that are unionized, probably the public workers are least liked by the general public. They think they're lazy, they think they're incompetent, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's untrue in the main. I think most public employees do a good job for their pay. But if you're going to pick on a unionized group, the one that will bring the public along with you fastest is the public employees. The old image, the guy leaning on his shovel while work gets done by somebody else.
Bob Hines.
Well, and we got to remind ourselves, too, that Governor Kasich in Ohio got a little overexuberant about a year and a half ago and went farther than he was able to push it.
When was Kasich not overexuberant?
Good point.
Very
he
good
sure
point.
Good point.
But, you know, he got his head handed to him by some of the public unions because he went too far.
Right. Alan Moore.
Well, it is a reminder of how big a hit the economy nationally and locally has taken in the last 5 years. And then you look at, John mentioned, certain employees who can retire in 20 years, maybe on disability, so they'll get like 70% of what they used to make. And there's been plenty of abuses in that system, including right here locally in the suburban county of Washington, D.C., And what that feeds is a lot of resentment. People are losing their jobs, and then they're realizing that their neighbor, who has been a local governmental employee, is maybe still working or now retired, and somehow the person trying to hang on to his or her house is trying to pay property taxes that are going to go to pay
for the retirement benefit of the neighbor. And it hits really close to home because public employees, in our general collective view, and it's accurate, are our employees. It's very different than how we see private sector employees, where we say, oh, some big monolithic corporation, employer, that's between them and their employer. These are our employees. They're paid with our taxes. They've got better job security and better lifetime long-term benefits than we do. We work harder than they do is a common impression. And with that kind of backdrop, that's why you've been able to see in Wisconsin, obviously in Ohio they went too far, but the public tends not to be big fans of those kinds of benefits and the kind of job security that public employees have, especially when things are bad and people are afraid about their job, their benefits, their house, et cetera.
When we look at the governor's mansions right now, you know, there was talk that we've seen the Republican Party have net gains in the governor's mansions nationwide. The Democrats have lost some of those mansions that they thought at some points were untouchable. But we're also seeing a lot of state legislatures going the way of the Republican Party. We see Republican-held state legislatures and governor's mansions. We thought that trend would continue in the presidency. Where was the breakdown between Governor Romney running for president and the succession of governor's mansions and the net gains that they've seen in the Republican Party nationwide? John Freshman.
Well, most of my Republican friends, of which I have many, will tell you that Romney was not a very good candidate. And that he was certainly, if you watch the debates as example, he was presiding over a fractured party that tried to pull itself together long enough to put together a presidential campaign. But the cracks were so close to the surface that they came out about 6 weeks out, and they just couldn't get healed again. And, you know, I think it's really as much about that. The fact is that the Republicans are better organized at the state and local level than they've ever been. And so it's just simply a dichotomy that... a paradox.
But Bob Hines, you've been around the Republican Party for a long time. How does the Republican Party take success at the state and local level and transfer that to a national level campaign?
They get a better candidate.
Is that the bottom line?
Well, let's put it this way. That'd be a good start. I mean, they need a better, I think nationally, it is fair to say that the Democrats have a much better ground game than the Republicans do. They've got a system that is much better and permanently in place than the Republicans have. And the fact of the matter is, the Republicans do great locally, but they don't have any unified, organized structure the way the Democrats do that can identify voters and can get people out. And that's the problem they've had in the presidency lately.
Carl Toobin.
Well, you know, we have friends, and in the 70s and the 80s, there were a big group of Democratic governors that were there. That has swung the other way. I think in 2014, you're going to start to see some of that trend reversed. I would think Michigan would be a spot where the Democrats have a good chance of winning. Virginia is another spot where the Democrats have a good chance of winning. And there are other states out there where if we put up good candidates, men and women, we will increase our governors nationwide.
You know, we talk about Virginia, and we talk about the unique situation of the governor's mansion in Virginia. It's basically a one-term wonder. It is a short-term limit. Basically, you get in for 4 years, and then we're automatically in a re-election. Is that a good idea, John Freshman?
I think it's a bad idea, because I think that what happens is the minute a governor gets elected, he's a lame duck. And the incentive of having to run for a second term is an important incentive towards finding the middle politically, compromising politically, and things like that. A lot of times, though, I think 1 6-year term for the presidency might be a better way to go. And I realized what I just said was contradictory.
Alan Moore?
Yeah, Virginia is a weird case because it is 1 4-year term, and because it occurs in an off year. So we're now in an election year in the state of Virginia, lo and behold, who knew? We'll all be knowing before long, and the Republicans. But I think it's a stupid system. I'm not a big believer in term limits in general. I mean, believe me, for the president, I have found some appeal in a single term idea of long. It would have to be longer than 4 years. But in six would be a one that people talk about. But maybe if you're going to go to one term in a state, maybe you go to something like that. But I've never been a believer in term limits because it seems to me to be anti-democratic, that let the people elect who they want. And, you know, if there's some advantages to the incumbency, fine. But there are also disadvantages to the incumbency, as we've all seen. Things are good, you get credit. Things are bad, you get blamed. And that's how it works. But I don't think we learn much from Virginia other than one at a time. I don't really agree that it means you can't reach across the aisle. The thing is, you got 4 years, and if you want a political future, you better make some friends, because maybe then you can run for the Senate. We've had a number of former governors, one-term governors of Virginia, who have served in the U.S. Senate. And I think that, you know, we've both sitting governors now, both Democrats, both sitting senators were governors. And previous ones have been elected, and other ones are always potential candidates. I don't like one 4 year term. I just think that's way too short. But there doesn't seem to be a stomach in Virginia for changing that anytime soon. You need to do it as a sitting governor, and no governor wants to use up a year's time trying to make it happen, because it's not going to help him.
Congressman, now, you know, when we see some of the media coverage of the National Governors Association, there's been talk that, in fact, the governor's mansions are going to have a lot more prevalence in the way that some of the national policy is going to be dictated in the future. Do you see that to be the case?
Well, it's going to be a change if it is the case. One of the, and I'm not suggesting this is good, but one of the things is that Congress doesn't pay much attention to the states at all, and it doesn't pay much attention to the governors. And they come back and they talk and they meet and they propound and so forth, and the congressmen and senators pay very little attention to it. I think they'd be better off if they paid more attention to senators than or to governors than they do.
John Freshman.
Yeah, but part of it is you have the governors filling a vacuum that is left by the absolute complete dysfunction, almost to the point of irrelevancy, of the Congress. I mean, look at them. They can't do anything. They can't step up to the plate on anything. So where else? Well, you've got to turn somewhere else.
Well, and
I mean the whole Congress.
Yeah, Congressman Al.
And I was talking from my experience, which is now 18 years old, and certainly things have changed, and the governors... Certainly, I don't think this Congress is going to pay any more attention to them, but other people may pay more attention to them than they did in the past.
Carl Tubin, last word.
It was very, very interesting where some of the Republican governors, you know, turned on the House Republicans, saying, you know, let's do it, let's get down, let's talk. And then they turned to the whole Congress and they said, let's go to work and get this thing settled. Whether it'll happen or not, who knows?
You know, one of the big news factors coming out in the past 24 hours is when you look at the governor's mansions, CPAC will be meeting in March, the Conservative Political Action Coalition. CPAC will be meeting, and one of the people that was not invited, notably Governor Chris Christie. Governor Christie, because of his actions after Hurricane Sandy, a lot of people in the CPAC community said he's not sending the right message. We've got to stick together as a party. We're not exactly supposed to be hugging the opposition president. Is that going too far, or is that type of bipartisanship something we need to see out of the governor's mansion? Alan Moore.
You know, I'm not sure what the trends are here. I mean, the governors learn they have to deal with legislatures. Sometimes the legislature is a single strong party. Sometimes it's a party of the opposition. It's a great training ground for learning how to make things work. But looking for trends, I don't know. I mean, the big problem for the Republicans today is there's still a major divide in within the party. The ultra conservative slash and burn, and the others who are more willing to work across the aisle. The Democrats are remarkably united for right now, We'll see if that holds up.
Well, we'll let that be the last word. When we come back in our next segment, we're going to be talking sequestration. We are 4 days away from going over the sequestration cliff, and the rhetoric gets really, really thick from here. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town, and I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu. The most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah.
F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We're going to turn right now to the topic of sequestration. Beginning Friday, sequestration cliff goes into effect, goes over the cliff, however you want to put it. Needless to say, the rhetoric says this is either going to be the biggest savior of our fiscal problems or the biggest disaster our economy has ever seen, depending on who you listen to. If you go to the Hill, the rhetoric is thick on the Hill. John Boehner is talking all kinds of great rhetoric, and the White House is following suit. President Obama continues to take the traveling roadshow for sequestration, going to the heart of different sequestration effects. He's down in the Hampton Roads area of Virginia, which is home to Naval Base Norfolk and the shipyards that build a lot of your big aircraft carriers. Bottom line, when we look at sequestration, Alan Moore, what's the reality on sequestration? Is it the fiscal disaster? Is it the savior of our fiscal problems? Is it somewhere in between?
It is definitely somewhere in between. This has been the most overhyped thing that I've seen for a long, long time. We've had this, people are suffering from catastrophe fatigue, and for good reason. It's not the apocalyptic Chicken Little, crying wolf matter. It's important, it's significant, it's real, but the impact has been overblown, and instead of the president calling together some people and saying,
this is serious. We're worried about a whole bunch of things. What can we work out? He has taken 5 trips in the last 10 days, including a little golf trip to hang out with Tiger Woods, and created these events with a backdrop of human props, talking about the disaster that's about to strike with a approximately 2.5 to 3% cut in spending. It's a stupid way to do things. Don't get me wrong. You don't just cut across the board. If you're going to cut, give some warning and give some flexibility to the leaders of an agency. I think before we're done, we're going to see that happen. The White House has resisted because it's a lot easier to attack things that are rigid than something that has a little bit of flexibility. If there were an easy fix for this, by the way, we would have long since done it. It is always painful to cut spending. Al has talked about this time and time and time again, how easy it is to spend money and how extraordinarily difficult it is to cut spending or increase taxes.
But when John Freshman, when you listen to the Republicans are saying, look, we have to invoke sequestration. It's the only way to go. It is easier to cut down at the knees and build up rather than taking the Democratic approach of just staying where we are and then taking away. How do you balance that?
I kind of admire the Republicans on this one. You know, every time they get to the table, they walk away with either taxes or spending increases. I mean, the reason that McConnell and Biden made the agreement so fast is because all they did is spend more money. The reason they extended the first Bush tax cuts the first time around is because all they did is spend more money. It's easier. And I kind of like these guys for saying, you know, it's too bad. And what's amazing is the way the conservative Republicans, and again, we're seeing, you know, Boehner's inability to control the House, and we all know that, but how they're willing to stand tall against going easy on the Pentagon. That's the biggest surprise, I think.
By the way, breaking news right now from Capitol Hill, the Senate is voting on the nomination of Chuck Hagel to be our next Secretary of Defense. We'll keep you up to date on that vote as it comes in. Back to sequestration. Bob Hines, you know, when you look at the rhetoric coming out of the administration, the Department of Defense has an entire website dedicated to sequestration. We've seen Secretary Napolitano today talk about Border Patrol cuts, TSA cuts, how we're going to shut down the nation's air traffic system because Secretary LaHood says we're not going to have enough air traffic controllers. Is this just rhetoric, or is there reality to this?
I have a little bit of a different view, I guess, than some people do with respect to this sequestration. This sequestration is a law. I mean, you can change it if you wanted to. But think about it this way. The real gut breaker here, the thing that's really going to blow up if it doesn't get done right, is not the sequestration situation. That's not a cliff. It's a slow thing. It's not going to be like everybody's fired on the 1st of March. That's the cliff. That's not going to happen. It's going to be a rolling slow thing if it happens at all in a real sense. The real problem we've got is on the 27th of March, the money runs out for the government to even turn a light on. And what we're really going to have to do, the biggest thing we've got to deal with, is a continuing resolution that funds the government for not just playing around with pieces of this and that and what we're going to cut, but funding the government from the turning on the lights to everything else they've got to do. And they're going to have to get that done. And my guess is that what we're going to have happen is we're going to start talking probably sometime next week, at least in background conversation between the White House, the Senate, and the House leadership. We're going to have to figure out a way to fund the government, and we will probably, as we do that, we will probably adjust some of the requirements within the sequestration. I would suspect that there will be an effort to find a way to give some of the administrative leadership of the various departments ways to allocate some of the problems they've got under sequestration to find a way to minimize the problems, but at the same time, they're going to have to fund the government, And I think that is the big thing we've got to look at.
Yeah, but Congressman Al, you know, if you listen to what we're hearing, for example, out of DOD, you've got the Assistant Secretary of Defense talking about this is going to be a disaster. Spending cuts would cause chaos, which is something that was put out by Deputy Defense Secretary Carter in a televised interview. If you look at the statistics, the DOD is saying that basically 2/3 of our ready force would not meet mission requirement suitability, that we're just not prepared to meet a defense role because these cuts are in place. Is that just rhetoric? And if so, why would the administration put out this quote-unquote scare tactic?
I think that, first of all, it's worth noting that the DOD has already given several times. Secretary Gates did a whole bunch of cuts, and Secretary Panetta did some cuts, and both of them said, you know, they did it willingly, and they did it against the wishes of some of the brass at the Pentagon, and then both of them said, but you can't go much farther. You got to keep in mind that we are an effective defense system for the world. You know, I remember the gentleman from Oklahoma.
Dakota Wood.
It was was a military man, and he said, "Yes, the French can go into Northern Africa, but they couldn't really do it if we weren't sitting there providing a whole bunch of background support for it." So I think we. As a guy who voted against the defense budget almost every chance he got, I am now saying that we had people in the Pentagon who weren't just grabbing more and more and more, but were already cutting, and we better be careful that we now don't overdo it.
Carl Toobin.
One of the big considerations here, and it might have started yesterday with the stock market dropping 200 points, is what's going to happen to the stock market and what's going to happen to a fragile recovery at this point when all this comes about.
Alan Moore.
I could sit and love listening all day to Al Swift defending the integrity of the defense budget. One of my favorite things. This is the second time it's happened. I thought maybe Carl was going to give him a attaboy, but the problem for the Defense Department, which is really bigger than almost anybody else's, because there's so many earmarks in defense and how the money is spent up because of a lot of intervention by people in Congress and so on, is everything gets cut equally. The Pentagon does not feel equally about everything by a long shot. And one of the ways to mitigate the negative impacts here is to grant the secretary considerable authority to move money around, so you don't have to cut everything by the same percentage.
Yeah, but Alan, you're talking about tying up an entire carrier group that can't go relieve
the entire carrier group already out there. That, I believe, has been a discredited claim. But the point is, it may be that if the cuts are automatic in across the board, your ability to be flexible is greatly restrained. But if you grant authority to the secretary to be more flexible and to move money around, you will have huge impacts in reducing all the negative stuff that they're talking about.
Congressman Al.
Well, I want to respond to what Alan said, but John may have a follow-on here.
Well, it's just
John Freshman.
It's absolute blue sky to think that they're going to give these agencies authority to move money around. They can't agree to walk around the block. They can't agree to do anything but a post office. They can't agree on anything, anywhere, at all, at any time. They're not going to give. They're not going to come together on a consensus to give these people more authority. It's not going to happen.
Alan Moore.
Well, I'll just remind John that giving that authority is exactly what the Republicans are asking for, and it's the White House that's saying, no, no, no. The White House is pushing back because the moment you grant more authority, the harder it is to make this exaggerated sky is falling case.
But the exaggerated sky is falling case, I mean, separate the Homeland Security case and the FAA case that's been put out by Secretary Napolitano and Secretary LaHood, respectively. You've got the DOD case where they've actually put the numbers to paper. You're talking about grounding all air wings of the Air National Guard. You're talking about not relieving carrier groups, which
you are not listening to me. You are not listening to me. If they can't change the rules of the sequester, some of those things will happen. If you look at the stuff, they'll say it could be this, it could be that. But if you grant them authority to move money around, then they can avoid the worst stuff. This is why the White House is resisting this notion of granting greater flexibility to the cabinet members.
But if pigs have wings, they could fly. It's not going to happen.
Well, no.
You can't blame any one person. It's not going to happen.
Hold on. Alan Moore.
After the sequester hits, and remember, we talk about an $85 billion sequester, but that's in budget authority. Now we get into budget stuff. That's about $45 billion in actual spending. It's just a little over half. In this year, the rest of it in the out years.
It starts
on day one. It starts very slowly, but as the implications become clear and clear, and as Bob says, we've got to solve the spending by the end of March. That's when you start making changes
to the
rules relating to the sequester.
But Bob Hines, regarding what Alan was saying, show me a president, show me a chief executive of the administration that is going to grant their cabinet secretaries the authority to move money around without the approval of OMB and, quite frankly, without congressional approval.
But I mean, John,
Bob Hines.
That's not how it works.
The White House,
the executive has the power.
Yeah, it's there in the president's office.
You mean to tell me that this president is willing to give up his overarching authority and give the authority back to the secretariat level?
No.
He doesn't have that authority under sequester. It's the Congress that will have to give it to him. That's the question.
John Freshman.
Exactly.
And they're not going to do it because they're going to give up their authority to do exactly what Alan said, contradicting himself a few minutes ago, to be able to direct how the spending is done inside the Pentagon, inside DOT. Yeah. They're not going to give up that authority. People are going to see right through
they
that.
They won't give up all the authority, but they're going to grant some authority so that the worst stuff doesn't happen.
Carl Tuve.
You know, we have to put a box on both houses of Congress, when this started, everyone talked about the way to do the cutting was to let the authorizing committees and the appropriations committees take a look at all the departments and see where we could save money and see where we could cut back. They didn't do it. Unfortunately, they didn't do it, and that's part of the reason why we're here. It was always said, the chairman know exactly where to do, exactly how to do it.
They have the super committee.
They cut the military budget when he was chair of the appropriations committee, and in conjunction with Carl Levin, and you know they did a good job, but they haven't acted responsibly. Both houses have not acted responsibly to do what they said they wanted to do.
But, you know, John, first of all, when we talk about, for example, DOD, DOD is now talking that they're going to have the largest bleed in sequestration. When you talk about DOD, DOD has already said, Secretary Gates said it, Secretary Panetta has said it, Congress is giving them stuff they just don't want. And the idea that they're going to sit, that Congress is going to sit there and say, all right, you do what you have to do. Well, as Secretary of Defense, I'm going to move money around. I'm not going to put total funding into Tinker Air Force Base. I'm going to move that to a joint base. That congressman's going to go absolutely nuts when that happens.
That's what I'm trying to say. But the reason they're getting the biggest hit is because of the fact that it does fall unequally because Social Security and Medicare and food stamps are exempted on the domestic side, and there are no comparable exemptions. But I want to say something else. This is a meat cleaver, and I don't like it either, and I'm not going to defend it. But if it does cause us to move towards not being the world's defensive system with a military budget bigger than the seven next countries combined, I'm all for it. It's time for us to stop defending the world and start coming home and taking care of our own stuff at home. And if this starts that process, yay.
Bob Hines.
I agree. and that's what's going to happen.
Congressman Al?
This might be a good opportunity where I can go back and defend myself.
Go ahead.
The difference between what I am saying now about defense spending and what I was voting on 20 years ago is that the Defense Department has already cut here in this point. 20 years ago, they were adding and adding and adding. And I was in a situation where I was voting against Star Wars, which I always thought was a ridiculous idea, while there were servicemen at NAS Whidbey, sailors, who were sacking groceries at the local Safeway store to earn a little bit more money to help pay for their family. Now, that's a very different situation than what I have been talking about.
Alan Moore, I mean, you're listening to you and Bob, Rush Limbaugh today said sequester panic is like Y2K. This is just a red herring. Is it a red herring?
You know, there are real effects. If you get furloughed or lose your job or your company is put at risk because of the way sequester plays out, that is huge for you. But it's important to keep perspective that we're talking about 3% of 1 year's spending. It's kind of horrifying to think that something that small in a budget and an economy that large would create such havoc. This is the overkill that I think the administration has played, which hasn't helped it. I just wish it would have spent more time trying to find some allies, and there are some in both parties, to say, let's figure out a better way. Let's figure out a better way, rather than stand in front of 25 uniformed police officers and say the thousands of people like this are going to have to take a furlough or possibly be laid off, or teachers are going to be let go. Listen, we have to do something about these annual deficits. The public supports the idea that we have to cut spending by 70-some%. The public even says, we don't care if you do it all by cutting spending. And then when asked, what would you cut? Nothing. No category got a majority. The highest number came for foreign aid, where 48% said, cut foreign aid. 49% said, don't cut it or increase it. That was the highest point, and everything else got less support than that. So it's, again, the public is sort of understanding there's a deficit problem that needs to be fixed.
And foreign aid is minuscule.
Foreign aid is less than 1% of the total budget. Medicare is 20%. Social Security is 21%. Food stamps is about 5%. These are huge programs that we all know we've got to wrestle with over the long term, but the public isn't buying in, and until we have an economic disaster, which we're all anticipating because of this skyrocketing deficit and the interest costs associated therein, it's a very tough system, a very tough problem. That's why we're at this stalemate.
Congressman Al, though, you know, the onus seems to be on Congress. The White House has marginally included itself in a lot of this, but the big bully pulpit, ironically, is with Congress. And yet there seems to be no coming together on any level as far as trying to prevent this quote-unquote economic disaster. What can possibly change in the next 72 hours that might fix this?
Well, the big bully pulpit perhaps should be with Congress, but I don't even think they've got little bully pulpits. You know,
they've got 535 pulpits, and they're talking at cross purposes.
Exactly.
Well, Alan Moore, you think that the Congress doesn't have the bully pulpit?
No, they got too many voices. There's one bully pulpit in this country, and it's been true for a long time, and it's in the White House. That's where the bully pulpit is.
Many inside the Beltway say the president hasn't utilized the bully pulpit.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. But I would
argue he's out using the bully pulpit right now.
You don't like what he's doing.
I think he's wasting the bully pulpit.
John Freshman.
There are disagreements about how he's using the bully pulpit. You certainly can't say that he's not using it.
Right.
The one question I would have is, you know, they formed this organization to lobby on the president's behalf, and yet the organization hasn't been asked to do anything on sequestration, as far as I know. That it's all about guns and other issues, but not sequestration. I mean, what would have happened if they had told this group to lobby Congress, to write to all the members, to call all the members, and let them know what's on your mind, and let them know about what sequestration would do?
Alan Moore.
Because nobody knows what to do. Nobody knows what to do. There's no plan out there. That's why, by default, we're falling back to this crazy meat cleaver approach.
Bob Hines.
We're going to get the meat cleaver, and 3 weeks later, we'll have to solve the budget problem. That's what we have to focus on.
Well, Congressman, are we seeing the beginnings of the perfect economic disaster storm?
Well, I don't know what the perfect economic disaster form would be. I think what we're going to get is not off the cliff. I agree with Bob that it's going to be slow, and I also agree with Bob that probably some other things will catch up with it along the line. But in the long run, it is going to hurt if we don't do it right. And by right, I think it's sit down and start dealing with entitlements in a rational fashion. I think we need to do that. And the thing is that by not debating how we do that, you leave the public with the impression that their Social Security is going to disappear, that their medical insurance is going to disappear, that it's all going to go away, and not introducing to it that you can change how much Social Security they get over time in out years, way out years, giving people a chance to prepare. You can talk about increasing the amount of that you put into Social Security over time. There are a number of things that you can lay on the table to have an effect on the entitlements that people aren't going to like, but are not the disasters that the lack of a debate about how to do it leads in people's minds.
Okay, real quickly, breaking news coming out of Capitol Hill. The Senate apparently has provided enough votes to confirm Chuck Hagel. So Chuck Hagel is now going to be the next Secretary of Defense. Leon Panetta is now booking his one-way ticket back to California.
A happy man.
He doesn't fly commercial, but he might have to start.
Bob Hines first.
Let me follow up on what Al just said, because that is, in many respects, the boogeyman in the closet. And the president has been, I think, fundamentally derelict in not beginning a conversation about that. It isn't that we're going to have to blow up Social Security. We're not going to have to throw people out of the hospitals. We have got to figure out a way to make those programs funded and sound. And it isn't a question of cutting off your arm. It's a question of cutting off everybody's little pinky finger at one joint and straighten out the program to the point where it is sound fiscally. And it can be done, and the president just won't even touch it.
Well,
hold on.
Carl Tubin, I'm going to give you the last word real quick.
That's not true. The president said yesterday in the speech that he would put these things on the table. He has said it before.
He's never done it.
Well, he said it yesterday again.
He talks a good game.
Gentlemen.
Well, we're going to let that be the last word. We're coming up on the break. We're going to continue the sequestration.
How can that be the last word when nobody has said that the Congress has a right to has a need to, has a responsibility to put some things out there too? The Congress is as silent as the president is on this.
I agree.
Well, when we come back, we're going to continue the sequestration debate. We're going to talk about sequestration and how it affects seniors and the non-discretionary spending when Daniel Marantz, who is the policy director for Social Security Works, will join us in the next segment. This is Happy Hour. We're going to order our drinks, cut our cigars, and start our second half. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Happy Hour on Backroom Politics is sponsored by Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., America's premier cigar tavern. Stay with us as the roundtable continues after we order our drinks, order our cigars, and get ready for the second hour of Backroom Politics. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Here live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining us now is Daniel Marins, the policy director over at Social Security Works, an organization that represents 300 local and state organizations. Daniel, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Daniel. Daniel, first of all, tell us a little bit about Social Security Works.
Okay, well, Social Security Works is sort of the convening arm for the Strengthen Social Security campaign, which is the largest liberal umbrella coalition for groups that, frankly, are opposed to any cuts in Social Security benefits. We'd actually like to see Social Security benefit increases. So that's what Social Security Works does in relation to that broader coalition. That coalition includes the AFL-CIO, the National Organization for Women, the NAACP, LULAC, you name it.
So Dan, help us out here. You know, we were just talking in our last segment about the effects of sequestration when it comes to FAA, DOT, and DOD. There's been a lot of talk recently about the effects of sequestration on seniors and the non-discretionary spending. What's your take on this?
Well, my take is that it will be huge. It will be devastating to seniors. There's no question about that. I mean, people forget that the Social Security Administration is right alongside the United States Postal Service and the Internal Revenue Service in terms of government agencies where Americans are most likely to encounter the government, period. In fiscal year 2012, 45 million people visited Social Security field offices, and 79 million people call the Social Security 800 number. Now, as it stands, the Social Security Administration has made a lot of progress on the backlog, particularly in applications for disability benefits. But that said, there still takes 109 days from the time someone applies for the disability benefit to hear their initial decision, and 345 days from an appeal hearing request to until they receive a decision on an appeal hearing request. Sequestration will just blow those numbers completely out of the water and reverse years of progress in that front. So to give you an idea, one day of furloughs, and they're talking about 6 weeks of furloughs of SSA employees in FY 2013 and in this year alone, one day of furloughs means a failure to process 20,000 retirement claims, 10,000 disability claims, and a failure to conduct 3,000 hearings. And those are figures from the Social Security Administration itself. Those are the best estimates that we do have, obviously, given that they are already not quite at the capacity they need to be meeting the demand that they have. This would just make things that much worse. We're talking about people waiting to get their claims, waiting to have the hearings if they're disabled in that case. And, of course, the effect that it would have on the economy as well, because those furloughs and, of course, the layoffs of 5,000 full-time employees would slow the economy tremendously.
When we talk about sequestration, we talk about the furloughs. It seems to me, depending on who you listen to, it's either just rhetoric or it's the reality that's coming down the pipe. What makes you think that the furloughs are going to be the reality, and how deep an impact it's going to have on the economy?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you right now, as it stands, SSA employees have been suffering already. I mean, that needs to be put out there. So we're talking about lower overtime. We've already seen furloughs in many SSA offices. We're seeing SSA offices close in rural parts of the country in many cases, where it is often very difficult to get to an office otherwise. So I couldn't tell you These are nonpartisan bodies that are giving these estimates, but it doesn't even strain credulity from a layman's perspective, given what the Social Security Administration is already experiencing and how tightly pressed they are.
Alan Moore has a question.
A point of clarification here. Did you say that one day of furlough is going to trigger 20,000 new applications for retirement benefits and 10,000 new applications for disability? Was that what you said?
No, I didn't say it would trigger those claims. It means that those claims would go unprocessed, because
unprocessed. I got it. Well, you talked about disability, and we have seen such an unprecedented and incredible flood of applicants into the disability system since 2008 that I'm amazed that there's anybody still left who hasn't applied yet.
You know, that's actually a huge misnomer, that somehow the standards for disability have been loosened, or that there are all these freeloaders coming onto the system. I mean, Kathy Ruffing of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities has explained that the increase in disability claims is due to a number of demographic factors. The ongoing increase in the retirement age, for instance, means that people that at the age of 65 and at the age of 66 who would normally have been brought under the, or rather at the age of 65, would ordinarily be brought under the retirement umbrella at that age, are staying on the disability rolls. That accounts for part of the change. Part of it is that women in the workforce who came into the workforce en masse in the 1960s and 70s are now reaching the ages of peak disability in their 40s and 50s. And of course, part of it is just the baby boom retirement, again, because peak disability time is in your late 40s and 50s, just before retirement. There is some reason to believe that there's a correlation of increased disability claims during economic downturns, but you tell me how we should deal with the issue of people in late middle age who've been laid off from their job and cannot find work. I'm not saying that, and in many cases, these are people that perhaps were partially disabled that thought they could hold off, but no longer can. So the idea that we have a sort of a disability problem in this country, or that people are kind of using this as a welfare program, is wrong in the extreme.
Well, yeah, but those were not my words. That was not my argument. My argument is there has been such an explosion of claims, which it stands to reason
if people are working and waiting for retirement and they lose their job and they think they've got a legitimate disability claim, then they're going to come and get it. And they have been coming in huge numbers. I haven't suggested, I don't know of any cases of abuse. All I'm saying, it was unprecedented, unexpected, and unfinanced. So I guess my question for you then is, what would you do? What would you like to see the government do instead of the furlough? Obviously, you start having further delays in applications. What would you do? Would you touch Social Security? It sounded like you said you wanted to increase benefits, not stabilize or reduce them. What's your plan for paying for it?
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm glad that we're actually getting into this discussion. I would say at this level, just so we make clear, sequestration would only affect administrative funding. So the funding that it takes, which is less than 1% of the program's annual total expenditures to run SSA's offices, process claims, do everything like that. That is the only thing that sequestration would affect. It would not affect benefit levels at all. So there's the separate issue of how we deal with the program's solvency and the simple issue of what I would call Social Security's modest funding gap. I want to take it, and so if we're going to proceed there, I want to take it in total rather than isolating the disability program per se, because as has been done in the past, there can be a simple transfer of some of the revenue from the retirement program. If that was done in 1994, that's something that can be done again. But in terms of the financial health of the program overall, there's some very simple steps that we can take that are in line with, quite frankly, the president and a mainstream position that is supported by vast majorities of the American public, which is making millionaires and billionaires pay in the same rate as the rest of average Americans. Very few Americans are aware that we stop paying into Social Security after we earn $113,000 in wages. And that number has been, the amount of earnings in the country that excludes has been going up in recent years as the amount of earnings above that cap, as the amount of earnings at the top of the spectrum grow. If we make millionaires and billionaires pay their fair share and we get our economy back on track again, okay, millionaires and billionaires paying their fair share just on its own, just paying the same rate. And again, literally, someone making $113,000 a year pays the exact same amount, absolute amount, into Social Security as someone making $1 billion a year. If we got rid of the cap, that would cover, at this point, about 90% of the shortfall. If the economy improved again as it was, and the projections were a little bit better, then it would cover the entire shortfall completely. Some combination thereof and I would also be in favor, by the way, of raising payroll tax rates a little bit. These are benefits that Americans want and believe that it's okay to pay for. I mean, and we have a retirement income crisis in this country. That's a crisis that no one in Washington is talking about. Private pensions are declining. 401ks and home equity are not the reliable source of savings and investments that they once were. And no one's providing answers of how we're going to do that. Well, we already have a great retirement savings program that works. We just need to pay for it.
Daniel, are you in favor of possibly means testing?
Means testing is a classic sort of backdoor way to undermine the program, because any kind of means testing that would generate significant savings would whack middle-class people. And I know that because only 2% of Social Security benefits go to people that have $100,000 of income or more in addition to their Social Security benefits. But beyond that, there is a fundamental thought of Social Security that this is a program that all Americans pay into, and regardless of their background, all Americans get out of. It's the reason that Americans don't view it as an entitlement. It's because we earn it with our benefits that we earn it with deductions from all of our paychecks. It's because it rewards hard work. Now, if you're trying to be progressive, there are plenty of ways to sort of pay for the program in a progressive way. As I said, lifting a cap would be a great way to do that. As it stands, the benefit formula is quite progressive. The idea to me that seems sort of absurd is that it would be very easy for us to that somehow it will be easy to cut the benefits of rich people, but it wouldn't be easy to ask for them to pay in a little bit more, which would have a much more significant impact on the program's finances.
Congressman,
I'm sorry.
Congressman Al has a question for you.
Yeah, and you may have addressed this. It's a little hard to hear you on the get-up that we have here. But I started paying Social Security when I was 14 years old. I paid Social Security all those years, and the fact is that somewhere along the line, I got lucky, and I have a sufficient amount of funds that I don't need Social Security anymore. So that talks about means testing. I think I have my Social Security check sent directly to my broker.
Well,
that's how much I
need
it. I send it to my broker, and she invests it, and I make more money. But I don't need that money. Why? And maybe you did say this, but why can't we means test the payout as well as other things?
Well, sir, here's what I'd, first of all, you are free under the current law to mail your check back. So if that's something you want to take upon yourself, I welcome that. The fact of the matter is, a means testing program that hit people who determines what someone doesn't or doesn't need, does or does not need. The fact of the matter is that only significant savings for the program, only significant savings for the program would be generated if we dipped into hitting middle class people, because there just aren't enough rich people out there.
I'm not a middle person. I'm not a rich person either, but I'm not worth millions of dollars. But I don't need the whatever it is $3,000-$5,000 a month that I'm getting. I'd get along just fine without it.
Well, sir, then I would ask: would you be willing to also pay into the program a little bit more then? Because right now, presumably over the course of, that's one thing I'd also be interested in. Social Security gets 3% of its annual revenue from income taxes that upper-income seniors pay on their benefits. So I'd be in favor of increasing some of that threshold. I'd also be in favor of increasing some of the earnings that are subject to the Social Security tax. But once you start going the route of reducing benefits for people, as I said repeatedly, I know that you may not be wealthy, sir, and I'm not sure what you consider that, but we'd be talking about hitting people that make 50 or 60 grand a year, not people not even people that are making 100 grand a year. So I think many of those people would be threatened, especially given the medical bills that some seniors face by the idea of reducing their benefits anymore. But I would also go to the political argument here, which is that we've seen what happens to programs that are seem to be excessively progressive. We've seen, for instance, what happens. Look at our means-tested healthcare program, Medicaid. It's a very difficult program administratively and bureaucratically, and it's also a program that, unfortunately, is not generous enough because the political support offered by it from the poor is not great enough. One of Social Security and Medicare's greatest strengths is that it has brought in the entire American people as stakeholders, and therefore it is seen as fair. It is seen as a program that the people earn through their benefits, and I believe it is. And it rewards hard work. It rewards savings, not rather than punishing it. And it is the political third rail for that reason. I would be very hesitant once you start. Keep in mind what we did to welfare in this country. When you start turning the rich against divesting the rich from the public infrastructure, they come back to cut the public infrastructure. And that's something that if you care about the goals of these programs, providing a meaningful social insurance and wage insurance, a system for saving in retirement, then we need to also protect it politically. That's why I'm also in favor of the payroll tax, which is a flat tax rate, because it's basically saying this is a program whose benefits workers are purchasing. They are purchasing with their own tax dollars. And there is some progressive stuff on the benefit side, but up front it's a flat tax rate that everyone pays in the same percent. Now, Franklin Delano Roosevelt saw that when he created the program. He said, someone said to him, these payroll taxes may not be good for the economy. He said, Well, guess what? This is straight politics. It's not economics. I put those payroll taxes in there so every American would have a legal, moral, and political right to their benefit. And I believe that remains the truth today.
Bob Hines, you have a question.
Yeah. Daniel, I've listened carefully, and I agree that, you know, we could probably – there are some adjustments you could make to raise the base at which their taxes are levied, et cetera. And I think that makes some sense. But let me also talk about some – get your views on some of the things I think that might be done that make sense in view of the realities of what we're dealing with as far as the cost problems. You know, when Social Security was created, a much, much smaller percentage of people lived to be 65. Now everybody's living at least 10 years older than that. I don't say we should go to 75, but what's wrong with moving up the age up a little bit, number one? Number two, what about changing the questions of the way the cost of living adjustments are made? There are several ways you could do that, which would save a little money. And it strikes me that what I'm hearing from you is we got to make this thing more progressive rather than we got to bring it under control.
Well, so first of all, I appreciate your comments. I think we have to look exactly at what is the cost problem that we're talking about, because the facts show that it's just not nearly as extreme as anyone has been suggesting. We built our Social Security system like we built our interstate highway system. It is a piece of our infrastructure, and from time to time, that infrastructure requires some maintenance. Now, Social Security as a cost, as a share of GDP, if we're going to even look at it as part of the unified budget, is going to peak at 6% of GDP from 5% that it is today. Peak. I mean, wages are scheduled to go up 10, 20, and 30% in those decades. So we're talking about an extremely modest increase in the cost curve that is eminently affordable. It's nothing like the skyrocketing cost curve of Medicare and Medicaid, though I hesitate to appear to be criticizing them, because I think that's an issue of private health care costs as well.
Let me make a comment. I think you need to be careful talking about an extremely modest increase and talk about millionaires and billionaires paying a fair share when you're talking about lifting the cap entirely on the system. Right now, Social Security is extremely progressive in its benefit structure. So people who have paid relatively short period of time, relatively modest amounts, can actually get back what they paid in a matter of just a few years. People who have been paying in at the cap for a long period of time may never get paid back what they paid in. It's 25 to 30 years. What you're talking about is blowing that apart and making it virtually impossible for wealthier people to ever get back just what they paid in, whether they need it or not, which is a different issue that Al was talking about. And there's been kind of this sacred bond in that system of everybody pays in, everybody gets something out. They don't really understand how the benefits are calculated, but they have a sense that there's some level of fairness. If you blow that apart, the way you've done with Medicare, the way we've done with Medicare, where somebody who makes 20 grand a year pays one-tenth of what somebody who makes $200,000 a year pays in, and yet they get exactly the same benefit. So one person pays 10 times what the other does. Somebody making $2 million pays 100 times. And you're talking about moving Social Security more in that direction. I think that you put at risk this sort of broad public acceptance of a system that would have those kinds of distortions in the way the benefits work.
Well, I'm not averse to that sensitivity, I would say. But if people are talking about ways to fund this, that's a pretty, I think, actually a relatively equitable way, given the way the current system's set up. Also, given the way the gains of the economy in the past 20 or 30 years have really only gone to the top 0.1%. So in that context, I'm not sure how unfair it is. But I am very sensitive to breaking the bond that you're talking about, and I would would worry about eroding that link too much. That's why proposals that do lift the cap, like Senator Sanders, Senator Harkin, Senator Begich's proposals, those are three Senate Democratic proposals that lift or eliminate the cap in some way, also create new replacement rates above that cap, so you do get some of that money back. But you're right, it would change the rate of return. I would only say this. The point of the program is not the rate of return. It's not the return on your investment. It's actually the replacement rate. And how effectively Social Security replaces your career earnings. We know that people, for various reasons, the labor market, bad market downturns, things like that, have tremendous difficulty saving an adequate amount to replace and maintain their standard of living in retirement. So that's what I would want to look at. The fact that there's a different return on investment, that's not the point of a wage insurance system. But I want to take, the fact remains that in terms of the pure cost curve, and again, I would favor some combination of lifting the cap, quite frankly, and I am not speaking on behalf of Social Security Awards. I would favor some combination of lifting the cap and raising the payroll tax rate, because I think it's worth it. And I think the American people, in poll after poll, including a poll conducted for the nonpartisan National Academy of Social Insurance recently, by a firm that did a creative kind of trade-off analysis, giving people many different options and asking them what they wanted, found that people are actually willing to pay that extra little bit to secure their Social Security benefits. I mean, at the beginning, when they first legislated the payroll tax cut back in the fall of 2010, we were looking at that there was a USA Today poll at that time that showed that 54% of Americans opposed the tax cut, because they were worried it would jeopardize Social Security's dedicated funding stream. This is not a tax that the American people view in the traditional tax way. It is an insurance premium. But I'd be open to that. But again, still, that cost curve is modest in terms of what it is as a share of our economy. And then that's the most important thing. In terms of the ratio of people paying in and whether people would lift to 65 or not, there's actually a lot of misnomers out there about that, because back in the day when Social Security was created, if you made it to 65, you were still going to live well into your 70s. It was the issues of infant and child mortality that people in particular had to worry about. So we actually like to look at life expectancy at age 65 when we're talking about that jump. But that said, those ratios, I mean, the ratio was initially very high because more people were there were all kinds of workers that were initially excluded from the program. By the mid 60s, it was already at 5-1 workers to retirees. By the 70s, it was already at 3-1, and that's basically where it is at now. And then it's basically going to plateau at 2-1. But it doesn't really matter to look at the worker retiree ratio so much as it does to look at whether we are increasing enough in terms of our productivity as an economy to fund that ratio. And we are. I mean, the economy is more than 12 times the size it was in real dollars since the 1930s. And productivity is only projected to increase in that time. And I would only add that, in fact, according to Virginia Reno from the National Academy of Social Insurance, a statistic that she cites, we were dealing with the same issue of dependency when we were paying for the baby boomer's childbirth. Because, again, the issue is not worker to retiree ratio. The issue is dependency. And when you're funding people that are not on the workforce, you're funding dependents. And we experienced a huge bump in school funding when the baby boomers became children and needed to go to school. And yet somehow we got through that blip and we moved forward and everything was fine. I want to give a chance for people to interject, but I do want to talk about the retirement age and the change CPI changed to COLA.
Well, Daniel, we're coming up on our break. We're going to have to break at this point. But Daniel Marin, Policy Director for Social Security Works, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate the debate.
It was really my pleasure, and I'd love to come back anytime.
Thanks, Daniel. Appreciate it. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Hollywood, Washington, and the connection between the Capitol and Tinseltown. By the way, FLOTUS announced Argo as the best picture. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt. Anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
Wait a minute, where's one more once? Well, we got time constraints here at Backroom Politics, like everybody else. We're going to finish our final segment here at Backroom Politics. We're going to take a little bit of a lighter note away from the Beltway. Well, kind of with the Beltway. So, over the weekend, in case you didn't notice it, the Oscars happened. And, lo and behold, after waiting 3 hours and change for Best Picture, lo and behold, Jack Nicholson introduces the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, to announce the winner of Best Picture, which, for those of you keeping track at home, was Argo. So, anyway, the reality is, it brings up the question. There has been a lot of talk, especially during the last presidential election, of the influence of Hollywood here in Washington, along with the fact that everybody calls Washington Hollywood for ugly people, which, if you look at the people around the table, you would agree. However, the reality
well,
is...
Well, except for Al.
Except for Al. Al's a handsome and distinguished fellow at the Simpsons Center. With the exception of Alan, I mean, when we look at the last presidential... Go ahead, Alan, defend.
I'm basking.
Enjoy the basking. So the subject
you get
is,
the basking award.
Actually, John is pretty good looking, too.
Can I continue the show, please? Thank you.
Aren't you going to say anything nice about me?
No. Again, can I get back? Can I get back on topic, please? Can I get back on topic? So the reality is, there's obviously a direct connect between Hollywood and Washington, particularly Hollywood and this White House. The question is, does Hollywood have a huge influence on Washington? Bob Hines, former entertainment mogul, you would know, how big of an influence does Hollywood have in the administration and in Washington today?
Well, they were once able to blow me out of the water, I can tell you. Way, way back.
I worked for TV.
Yeah, I worked for the audience. I worked for NBC, and we had some problems with the Hollywood studios, and we had made a very good case for ourselves, and I was received a telephone call from Jack Valenti at one point, who said to me, Bob, he said, I want you to know that today when the hearing comes off, the decision made by the agency, the FCC, that you agree with, is going to be overturned. On orders of the president, he had a call from Lou Wasserman, who owned Hollywood in those days. And I went up to the hearing, and I watched myself be absolutely wiped out. And, you know, we had a good case. We did all we could, but we didn't have what we needed, which was we didn't have the high poobah of Hollywood called, his client was Ronald Reagan when Ronald Reagan was in the movies.
Right.
And the client agreed with Hollywood, and we got killed.
But, you know, when we look at, you know, I mean, we've never seen a first lady announce an Oscar win. I mean, that's never been done before. The word on the street is that Harvey Weinstein,
right,
big Hollywood executive, was able to pull that off. So when we look at the money, George Clooney, Matt Damon, Spielberg, Babs, when you look at the money that they generated, particularly for this president, particularly in the last election cycle, does Hollywood have an undue influence on Washington? Carl Tubin, I'm going to go to you. You used to represent one of the big movie studios.
20th Century Fox, and they do. And another story about Reagan is that Lou Wasserman brought a whole bunch of people in one year, and they talked to the president. They talked to the president about an issue at the FCC, and the president said, I'll take care of it. They came in a year later, and the president looked at them and said, Lou, what are you here for? He says, we're here for the same issue that happened last year. He said, really? Wasn't it taken care of? He said, no, sir. And Reagan picked up the phone, called Fowler at the FCC,
yep,
and said, I want this done today. And it was done. Now, that goes all the way back. In the Kennedy administration, there was Frank Sinatra
and the Rat Pack.
And the Rat Pack. And plus a lot of movie moguls who came and supported Kennedy. But Reagan also had a lot of Hollywood support when he ran for president. So, you know, it both sides happened. But Harvey Weinstein was the key to this one. He wanted his show, his movie to win, which it did, and he wanted the president's wife to be part of it.
But don't, John Freshman, don't confuse all of us. Don't confuse celebrity and appearance and bling with influence. I mean, the influence is that it's a very wealthy, homegrown community that still makes a lot of money, and they give money, by and large, to Democrats, just like the Koch brothers give money to Republicans. They have a lot of influence.
But the Koch brothers haven't been nominated for an Oscar.
That's respectfully irrelevant. It's just about the money. There's a reason why every Democrat goes to Hollywood, and it ain't to see the actors, it's to see the color of their money, and that's what this is. Now, if Michelle wants to have a little fun and do that, let's not pretend that that's serious, for crying out loud. You know, that was just a fun little thing that came and went that nobody will remember in a month.
But Alan Moore.
Yeah, it seems to me that in terms of Hollywood influence, when it's an issue that gets at their pocketbook, that's when they go to collect on their investment. Bob told his story. Carl mentions the story. I'm guessing that there is some payoff for their narrow pocketbook issues because of the money and a little bit the glamour. There are people who are Hollywood figures who come here. Some of them are dilettantes, and they'll involve themselves in an issue a couple of times. They'll get access. They'll get some press. They'll lose interest. There's a handful of Hollywood celebrities who have, over the years come back and come back and come back and come back, and they can have some influence. They can draw attention, and I have great admiration for them. But we shouldn't think that because they might have the occasional interest on a narrow issue or have disproportionate interest on issues that, for, that, that affect their pocketbook, that anybody cares what they think about Social Security or the sequester or defense policy. That's nonsense. They do not have that kind of influence. As for the other night with Michelle Obama, I think it was so weird that people sort of thought, "What? I'm a big fan of Michelle Obama. Don't get me wrong. That didn't really work for me." And she had these soldiers behind her in uniform, and she didn't make any reference to them whatsoever. I'm guessing we will never see that happen again.
John Fresh, however, we do have to agree that it worked slightly better than Clint Eastwood talking to a chair.
Right. I gave you time for that. Congressman Al.
Or
an ex-murderer.
Or I was going to say Captain Kirk, for that matter.
Hold on. We're live on the air, by the way, guys. Carl Tubin.
There's another part of this. Somebody from Hollywood must have come to New Jersey, got some sand in his eye or her eye, and then turned around and Hollywood got $150,000 for productions and to spread around from the Sandy Bill. And that is pretty
powerful.
Which
leads me to my next point. You know, when we look at, for example, George Clooney, eloquently done, went to the Hill numerous times talking about the issue in Darfur. We've seen Sean Penn, not nearly as eloquent as George Clooney, go to the Hill and talk about the issue in Haiti. We have Ashley Judd now being considered a credible Senate candidate out of Tennessee. So, or out of Kentucky, I'm sorry. So when we see this, and not to mention that the guy who used to play Stuart Smalley on Saturday Night Live is the senior senator out of Minnesota. Does that not lead to the fact that maybe Hollywood does, through its presence, its celebrity, give policy push to Washington, D.C.? Alan, Congressman Al, you're a former media guy.
Well, I remember that incredibly powerful and influential member of the House, Sonny Bono.
Was that sarcasm?
No, that was sarcasm.
Wait a minute. I would say that Sonny Bono was very effective as a congressman, just as Fred Grandy, the guy who played Gopher on Love Boat, was very effective for me.
Well, and we had a president who started out in Hollywood. So
very true.
But these are unique.
Look. Congressmen will just absolutely drool over a Hollywood star. Hollywood stars drool over congressmen and senators. They each see each other as somebody very important and that they want to know. In terms of their ultimate influence on specific issues, I think it is almost zero. Now, if somebody like Bono, and I'm not meaning
Sonny
Bono, but
you mean Bono, the lead singer of U2?
Bono, I think, may have a little influence simply because he's put his money, time, and effort where his mouth is, and it's on a narrow little group of issues in which that he has invested himself. But basically, they're brought in. The Lenny would bring them in. The stars. Because members drooled over Alan Alda and Woody Allen and those kinds.
But you know, Congressman Al.
And who did Bob have? He had an executive whom I knew, a nice man, a very nice man, bald-headed man in a three-piece suit who looked like a banker, and he was making his presentations while all these stars were making theirs, and so who won the hearing?
We had no chance.
But I want to bring up, you know, Congressman Al, you bring up a good point. Alan Moore, we talk about Bono. Bono was very effective in getting support for the globalization of the AIDS epidemic and getting the U.S. to buy in.
Bono is the exception that helps prove the rule.
Yes. Okay.
There are a number of people, he's the best example, because for 12 years,
right,
he has labored in these vineyards. He knows the issues. He knows the players in America, in Europe, in Asia. He's traveled to Africa. He's a fascinating, charming guy. He won Jesse Helms over. I used to get to watch that happen. we'll talk about that some other time. You know, and Jesse took his grandchildren to a Bono concert, and he was down in the mosh pit. I mean, it was the most amazing thing ever. But Bono is truly extraordinary. But he has stayed with it. And staying with it, doing your homework, and then trading information internationally to heads of state. I've never seen anything like it, and it takes a really special guy, a special issue.
And that's how you get influence, by committing yourself to the issue. Just showing up and smiling doesn't do it.
His celebrity got him access, but then he proceeded to use it with knowledge, sensitivity, and caring.
Well,
is he in Hollywood? Is Bono in Hollywood?
Yeah, theoretically. The recording industry's out of Hollywood. Why not?
I just wondered if he was a movie star.
Dublin's the Hollywood of Ireland. Come on, let's call it what it is. But the reality is, you know, I mean, they're talking about Alec Baldwin running for possibly a congressional seat. His name keeps up. Any Baldwin brother could run for any district on Long Island.
Yeah, but I think he just hit somebody the other day, so that's what four.
So he's out. All right, that makes sense. So, bottom line, Hollywood doesn't have the influence that you'd think, that Harvey Weinstein calling up the White House saying, hey, I need Michelle to do this. There's no influence there, Bob Hines?
Oh, hell yes, there is. But, you know, those are personal favors for people who know they know each other. That's the point. I mean, when Lou Wasserman called Ronald Reagan, he was talking to a former client.
Right.
And, you know, who helped make Ronald Reagan's career. And they changed the policy just like that, which is okay because, you know, Carl over here was on the other side, so I was outnumbered.
Yeah, Carl was working for 20th Century Fox back then. My God.
Yeah, right.
Talk about big money. Hey,
my first client.
You have to rub that in? Really? Really, Carl?
Yeah.
All right, with that, we're going to go to my favorite segment in the show. This is the part of the show where we talk about buzz, innuendo, and hearsay around the Beltway. It's time for Tell Me a Story. Joining us for Tell Me a Story is our international expert. He is the Vice President of Eurasia Affairs, or the Vice President of China Affairs, to the Eurasia Center. He's Dr. Ralph Woody. Ralph, how you doing?
Doing great.
Ralph, I'm going to start off with you. Tell me a story.
Okay. I think we've all read that the IOC has recommended to drop wrestling from the Olympics. What has recently transpired is the wrestling federations of Iran, United States, Cuba, and Russia are joining forces and sharing information in an effort to save the sport of wrestling. This is being compared to the diplomacy in the early 70s, the ping pong diplomacy, which led to the U.S. engagement with China. So watch this continue to develop.
Interesting, interesting point. Congressman Al.
In terms of letting public know, what was your major sport in college?
Of course it was wrestling.
Yeah, there we go. That's what I want, loser. Full disclosure. Congressman Al, do you have a story today?
I do have a story today.
Congressman Al, tell me a story.
I believe that by the next presidential election, the Tea Party will be of almost no importance, because two things will have happened. One, a lot of them will have become educated enough to be reasonable congressmen and understand the process, and the others will not be relevant.
Very good. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
I'm going to repeat one, a thought that I really believe is going to happen, that I had mentioned about a month ago. I continue to believe, and I think we will see before spring is out, that the pipeline...
The XL pipeline
will be approved. I think the Greens have lost their best advantage. That was the pipeline went through the sand hills where the aquifer is.
Right.
The path has been changed of the pipeline. The governor of Nebraska has signed off on the changes, and I suspect that the unions who will get the jobs in building the pipeline and managing it, I think basically they will overcome the Greens, and I think they will have the pipeline approved before the end of spring.
And add to that the fact that they allowed Obama to disagree with it before the election, but they didn't tie him down for after the election.
That's right, right. Good point. John Freshman, tell me a story.
A lot of us were wondering what kind of Senator Ted Cruz was going to be. Incredibly bright. He went to all of the great schools. Anybody who's met him says he's incredibly bright, and he's had the worst start of any senator in modern times. And he's out Jim Demented, Jim Dement. I mean, it's like
we got
like crazier. And some of the things that he said, and this just sticks in my craw, when he starts criticizing Chuck Hagel, who goes to Vietnam and gets wounded, and starts questioning his belief in military readiness. Somebody should have called him out on that, and thank God John McCain did.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay.
Carl Pittman, tell me a story.
I've got two.
You get one.
No, they're both on point. Okay?
All right, you get two. Quick.
when Senator Franken first came to this city, I was in a reception. I went over to him, and I said, Senator, what the Senate needs and what the Congress needs is more levity. He turned to me and he said, no. He says, that is my old profession. I'm here to do serious business for the United States and for Minnesota. 6 years later, I see him at a reception, first day of Congress, and I reminded him of the conversation, what he said. He looked at me and he paused, he looked at me and says, you know, Carl,